From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On the latest episode of The Sopranos, Vito Spadafore got whacked. He'd fled to New Hampshire after he was spotted dancing at a gay bar, and when he returned to Jersey, he didn't last long. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the actor who played Vito, Joseph Ganascoli. He has a new crime novel about a chef who's connected to the mob. And we hear about some of the great films and some of the bombs at this year's Cannes Film Festival from our critic at large, John Powers. The festival wrapped up over the weekend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On the latest episode of The Sopranos, Vito Spadafore got whacked. Bad news for Vito, but not so bad for the actor who played him, my guest Joseph Ganascoli. He had a big part this season. A couple of guys collecting protection money at a gay bar spotted Vito dancing there. After word got out, Vito panicked, left his wife and two kids, and fled to New Hampshire, where he got involved in a relationship with the owner of a diner who he nicknamed Johnny Cakes. Vito lied to Johnny Cakes and told him he was a writer from Scottsdale working on a book about boxing. Here's a scene right after Johnny Cakes figured out that Vito wasn't who he said he was.
Are you even a sports writer? I mean, here we are talking about taking the next step in this relationship. I ask you to share my home, and you can't even be straight with me. This. Nice knowing you, Vincent.
Jimbo, come on. I'm not a writer, okay? I'm not from Scottsdale. And the car's not my sister's. I'm actually from New Jersey.
I knew it.
Some went down. I had to leave. My home, my contracting business, my wife, my kids.
Are you drunk? It's not even 11 o'clock.
You think it's easy? I miss home so bad my heart's a f***ing lump. I'm barely holding together. Stuck in the sticks, running out of money. And now this? You think I was looking for you?
Soon after this scene, Vito decided to return to New Jersey, where mobsters were waiting to kill him. Joseph Ganascoli was a chef before he became an actor, and he recently co-authored a novel called A Meal to Die For. It's about a gourmet chef who's connected to the mob. Joseph Ganascoli, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on this season. It was you've just been really good. It's been a great part for you, and it was really fun to watch you.
Thank you.
Now, you've said that it was you who suggested that Vito, your character, be gay. What made you think of suggesting that?
Well, it was from a book I was reading called Murder Machine by Jerry Capici. I used to write Gangland for Daily News. And I was just trying to find a way to broaden my character and give me more to do. And seeing that it does happen, there's something you never see really portrayed that much on mob shows, on movies, I thought it'd be interesting, and I brought it into, and this was in the middle of season three, I brought it to the attention of Robin Green and Mitch Burgess, who write and produce, no longer anymore, but so they were interested in it. They said, oh, really? And I showed them the book, and I gave it to them, and it's not exactly what I had in mind when that security guard, I was on the wrong end of that.
But, you're talking about the security guard in the car. Meadows' boyfriend, when he's working construction, sees you in a car in a compromising position with a security guard.
When I first heard about it, Gandolfini had said, we'll go talk to Chase. You don't have to do this if you don't want. And I said, no, I'll trust them. And I just asked that I just not show it, and that's the last we hear of it. I mean, because I was watching it with 20 people. I didn't tell them. And they were like, almost fell off their chair.
Now, all the people in Tony's crew are revolted by the idea that Vito is a homosexual. And after Vito is outed, they no longer trust you. And it's obvious, pretty obvious right away. You're going to get killed eventually. Do you have any friends who are as homophobic as the characters in The Sopranos and who were revolted by your portrayal in the same way that the characters in the series were revolted by Vito when they found out who he was?
Yeah, my friends were like, me, how many times are you going to kiss this guy? And they would ask, if I would have killed 20 guys in the night, there would have been, a lot more pleased with that. But to be with another guy, it's something else. Anybody that's really vocal about it, I think they usually have some issues with themselves. I mean, I'm very secure. And if anything, I was a lesbian. I was chasing girls my whole life. And I just recently got married, so I never had a problem with it because I'm very secure who I am. I'm from Brooklyn also, and I go to restaurants that, known mob hangouts, and, some guys give me dirty looks, They're a little upset about it, but, I'm acting, and, it happens, and it's a role that maybe, you know, made a name for myself, so I don't have a problem with it.
Just as your character of Vito is becoming sympathetic, you know, and we realize, oh, you know, this character's been repressed. He could have had a different life. He could have had a better life. You know, he didn't necessarily have to be, you know, killing people in the mob. Then, you know, you decide that even though you're in New Hampshire, that you're in New Hampshire and you miss your kids and you miss part of your old life in the mob. So you leave New Hampshire and you're driving on this like country road going back to Jersey, and you hit a car that stopped next to a mailbox, and the driver has been checking his mail. The driver insists that the accident has to be reported to the insurance company, and you can't afford to do that because then you'd be discovered and probably killed. So you just shoot him in the back of the head. And, man, I thought the writers were so brilliant in that scene because really you're not a good person in the series. You know, you've killed other people. You shot Jackie Jr. in the back of the head, and that's just like one of the things you've done. And you still have it in you to just be a killer. Did you like that scene?
Up until then, I thought I was very sympathetic. But one thing great about David Chase is that he doesn't want you to really like these people. Whenever you know, people start saying, hey, they're regular guys, you know, they're sitting around watching a game, we're at a strip place, or they're, you know, just hanging out. And then they do something like when Paulie Walnuts had to kill his mother's friend just to give Tony, you know, some money. And when people are thinking like, yeah, you know, the guy just wants to, you know, live and let live. He shows them that it's who they are. They're killers. They're, you know, not nice people. And I was upset about that because, you know, I thought, you know, all these people are going to really think I'm a sympathetic character. And I did that. But that's what he does. He doesn't want you to like these people. That's who they are. And Vito missed a life, and he wanted to get back and, you know, get back in the mob life. And that's what he missed, the action. It was a little boring, although it was great seeing people, you know, gays living with straight people, getting along and living, let live. But it's that other life that he missed, and his kids, you know.
Let's talk about how you were killed. There's like three guys with bats who are waiting, baseball bats, waiting for you in your motel room.
Pool sticks.
Oh, pool sticks. Oh, I remember them as bats. Okay, they're pool sticks. Yeah. So and then Phil Leotardo, who's the number two in the New York mob, is just like sitting on the bed, watching as they beat you to death, and of course you're his brother-in-law. Can you talk about shooting that scene and how much of a beating you actually took in it?
Well, first of all, did you notice what Phil came out of, right?
What do you mean? What he came out of? Oh, he came from behind the curtain. You mean?
No.
Was it a closet?
Came out of the closet.
You know, in my mind, I always remember things wrongly. In my mind, he's like standing behind like the drapes in the room, and he comes behind. So he came out of the closet. That's funny.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
yeah,
really
that's funny.
Funny.
That's David Chase's sense of humor.
Boy, that went right past me.
Yeah. So they, first of all, because of my, you know, I just had double hip replacement.
In real life.
Yes. 7 weeks ago. And you always see me limping on the show. Mm-hmm. And my legs are crooked. It's really hard to watch. Now, you know, I'm pain-free. I was in so much pain, but I'm pain-free. And so it was hard to do a lot of these scenes. And I, for the most part, I tried to do as much as I could. And, you know, in the fight scene, I couldn't get down. But I pushed the guy, and I did as much as I could, but it was very painful. But so I walked in, and they didn't really, they didn't hit me. They hit the stunt double. Or did they hit me? I think they did hit me, but then I was down on the ground. They showed that. But a lot of the stuff my stunt double did. And that scene there, I mean, it was really pleading for my life, and it was very emotional. And
you're pleading with gaffer's tape over your mouth. You're trying to plead.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. They didn't use a lot of it, which I was surprised about. I remember I actually had chest pains because I was really, you know, pleading for my life, and I was upset that they didn't use more of it because I thought it was a great moment for me. Because you saw the terror in my eyes, you know.
What was it like for you to watch the scene in which you get beaten to death?
Well, you know, I had 60 people at my house watching it Sunday. And I, you know, it was a nice party. I knew something bigger was going to happen, but You know, I was just thinking back, when, especially in Paris, which they show too much of, but David Chase's wife is French, so. When I heard that, you know, the next episode, they're going to Paris, I was like, you know, I said, oh, man, hopefully I'm going. Maybe I'd, you know, throw me off the Eiffel Tower or I'd be death by foie gras, which would have been great. I'm the only guy on the show to play two different characters. I had one scene in the bakery when Michael Imperioli shoots the kid in the foot. You know, it's a little, again, a little homage to, or homage to Goodfellas when they shot him in the foot. But in the bakery scene, I played Gino, who was trying to get bread, and I get thrown out of the bakery, and Michael wants respect from this kid, and he shoots him in the foot. So I was looking, but just thinking back of all this, you know, then they brought me back for Vito Spadafori, and I got that role, and then I got, you know, when I heard first heard I was killing Jackie Jr., I was just going back and thinking about that, knowing that this scene with the motel room is coming up, and you know, my it was coming to an end. But on this show, you know, you never really end because you come back in dreams, and I'm hoping I do.
Are you going to come back in dreams?
I hope. I haven't gotten that call yet or that word, but that's only for an episode. Look, I mean, Drea, she was back, right, in that episode?
Oh, yeah. How much contact do you have as an actor in The Sopranos with David Chase, who's the, you know, creator and the kind of key person in overseeing the series? Do you talk to him directly about where it's heading and where your character's heading?
You know, up until then, I didn't really see him much, talk to him much. I approached the writer, and then she told David, I guess, you know, make him gay. He called me in the beginning of this year, wondering how much weight I had lost, and so so he knew how to write it in. It was a big thing in the first couple of episodes, and then you know, that Thin Club ad we did, which was pretty cool, and then after when I was out of that in the leather bar, I said David, I'd like to talk to you, and I says, look, you know, I just got married. I got a house now, mortgage. What's going on with my character? He goes, well, am I going to live? And he goes, no. You're going in 11 or 12. He didn't know yet. And he says, you sabotage yourself. So meaning that, you know, I could live my life and everything would have been fine. Or, but you come back, you should miss the life. And that's what happens. And I think Tony would have let me live in AC. You know, he was sticking up for me and Earn, because I was going to give him $200,000, and you know, would have had some money coming in, but Phil got to me, and that was it.
No, Tony was planning to kill you, though. He's just insulted
that
Phil Leotardo, you know, took out one of his own guys, but Tony was going to get someone to kill you. Every time Tony has a good instinct, he thinks better of it.
Yeah, it's true. That's right. He says, no, he's got to go.
My guest is Joe Gennascoli. He played Vito Spadafore on The Sopranos. He also co-wrote a crime novel called A Meal to Die For. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Gennascoli. He played Vito Spadafore on The Sopranos. Vito was killed on the latest episode. So this season, you lost a lot of weight in real life. I read it was like 160 pounds while the show was on hiatus.
Uh-huh.
Did you have to like tell the people, I lost 160 pounds, so you'd better write it in?
No. They know I did it. Maybe at the end of season 5, which is maybe like almost 3 years ago now, I had the band. See, I was very thin, and then I started opening restaurants, and I started gaining weight, maybe 10, 12 pounds a year. I stopped going to the gym. I didn't have time to work out, stopped being active, and then my hips were bothering me, so I didn't realize what it was. So I went less and less and started eating and drinking and gambling, which we'll get into about what's in my book. But 10, 12 pounds a year, and then finally I had enough. So I had the band done, the gastric band, and you know, I started, that was in the end of season 5, I had it done. And when we came back, I just, you know, was losing weight. So if maybe 2.5 year period. So they knew I had it done, and they knew that, you know, there was going to be a weight loss. So they worked it into the script.
There's several characters on the show who are very heavy. I mean, over the years, like Big Pussy, Bobby. Tony's put on a few pounds lately.
Yeah, Tony put on. Well, Bobby Bacala, they put a fat suit on him.
Oh,
that
really?
It wasn't his gut. No. Oh. He's a big guy, and he put on some weight, but that wasn't, he had a big gut on. They took it off him this year.
Huh.
Tony's put on weight, and I think that was for another role he did. And I think it goes with his character. I mean, that's an end joke. Like, you know, 9 times out of 10, anytime you see him, it's usually in the house. He's always eating.
Do you think your weight helped you get the part?
Yeah, I think it definitely did. I think they were looking for a big guy. I mean, there is a lot of big guys in the mob. You know, they eat. There's a story about this guy, undercover guy. He put on 80 pounds, you know, when he was doing undercover. You know, because it's all about restaurants and eating out and, you know, it's the life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joe Gennascoli, and he plays Vito Spadafore in The Sopranos.
Played,
yes. That's right.
We could use past tense now.
He's been whacked. It's all over for Vito unless he comes back in dreams. But as for Joe Gennascoli, this is probably really good for you. I mean, you have so much attention now because of this this season that probably opened up doors for you.
And I hope so.
And also, I want to ask you about your novel. You have a novel that you co-wrote called A Meal to Die For, subtitled A Culinary Novel of Crime. And this is about a guy who owns a restaurant that's you know, connected with small-time crime. You've worked in a lot of restaurants. You've owned one or more restaurants. Do people want to think that you've been connected? Does that give you, like, more cred as a Sopranos character?
Well, I think we all were at one point. We know guys that are in this life. You know, being from Brooklyn, I know who is and who isn't and what's their position and so on and so forth. But this book I wrote was loosely based on my life as a chef, and I was a bad gambler. I used to gamble a lot. I mean, that's what led me to acting. But I was, when I was gambling and losing, I used to lose, you know, you win, you lose, but you never beat the bookie. You never beat the odds. And one Sunday I lost $60,000 in gambling on football games, 15, 15, and then 30 was my get-even game. And if I ever win an award, I got to thank Cody Carlson because he was the backup quarterback for the Houston Oilers back in 1990, and it was a Sunday, and they were resting their players for the playoffs. The Pittsburgh Steelers, number one defense, were resting their players. And Cody Carlson, the backup quarterback for Warren Moon, threw for like 500 yards, and I was just like sitting in there watching the game stunned and thinking like, I just lost $60,000. I got to get out. I got to pay everybody off. I got to sell my interest in the restaurant, and I'm moving to LA to pursue acting.
What made you think you'd make money as an actor?
Back then, before you even answer that. So, but when I was winning and losing, you know, I was to help pay my debts off. I was became known as a food fence. And
what's a food fence?
A food fence like a jewelry fence, but I knew how to move hot food. And wine with phony labels, homemade wine, we would make phony wine labels and sell them, you know, not what it was. Or oil transfusions, we call them, and, you know, canola oil cut with, like, some bootleg olive oil, and then we'd, you know, recan them or we'd rebottle them. So I knew how to do that.
So you basically put cheap food in fancy bottles.
Yeah, it wasn't what it said it was. Not that it was bad. I mean, you know, I said a little integrity, but it just wasn't what it said it was. And so on. So,
you felt okay about doing that?
Well, at the time, and I was like hustling, you know. It was something I would use, but it just wasn't what it said it was. And, you know, I was hustling. That's what we do in Brooklyn.
So you didn't mind that you were taking advantage of people?
Well, you know, back then, I have more scruples now, or some, but and that's what the book's about. But you know, this is how I had it. You know, I hustled. You know, if someone said, "Listen, I got this shrimp," you know, can you move it? And I say, "Yeah, I'd move it."
Okay, now in movies and TV shows, when that happens, what happens is in the long run is that this character who got in, you know, who put his toe in the water in dealing with the mob, ends up kind of getting deeper and deeper and deeper until he drowns, you know, until he's like so deep into crime that he's either, you know, put behind bars for life or he's killed by one of the other mobsters. How are you able to be a food fence and then get out?
Well, I mean, it didn't always, I lost everything and I said I was getting out. You know what I mean? I mean, I cashed out and...
And no one said to you, you can't leave now, Joey.
No. It wasn't like that. I said, listen, I'm done. You guys, you know, I'm getting out of the restaurant business. I just lost a ton of money and I'm going to pursue acting. And, I mean, in real life, when I was doing it, I was chef of a restaurant in Manhattan, and someone asked me to be in a play of a good friend of mine, who was actually was a Jesuit. So this guy was going to be a priest, but then he got out of the Jesuit, and he was working as a waiter, and he asked me to be in this play. It's called The Juice Man, about a loan shark on the docks. And I liked it. I got it, and I liked it. And I got out of the restaurant business. I started selling ice cream from a cart in Wall Street and just studied acting.
Joe Ganascoli played Vito Spadafore on The Sopranos. He's also co-authored a crime novel called A Meal to Die For. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral degree programs online at capella.edu. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with critic-at-large John Powers about some of the best and some of the worst films at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Also, the little lie that helped Joey Ganascoli establish himself as an actor. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Joseph Ganascoli, who played Vito Spadafore on The Sopranos. Vito was killed in the latest episode. Ganascoli also co-wrote a crime novel called A Meal to Die For, about a chef connected to the mob. Ganascoli used to be in the restaurant business. When we left off, he was telling us that he decided to get out of the business and pursue acting after he lost $60,000 gambling.
I called up my friend Tim Kelleher, who's a working actor, and I said, Tim, I told him what happened. He goes, I said, I'm just going to go out in L.A. and pursue it. And I did that for 3.5 years, just getting bit parts, and I was hustling. But, you know, I was tired of being broke again. I moved back to L.A. My family wouldn't even talk to me for the first year because of, you know, what I did. I lost everything. I left this girl I was seeing and so on. And then I was, you know, working menial, cooking and jobs, cooking in the restaurants and not making much money. I was tired of that. But, you know, again, because I'm from Brooklyn, what I used to do is, you know what the breakdowns, I don't know if you know what the breakdowns are.
Is that for betting?
No.
Oh.
Breakdowns are what the casting directors...
Oh.
Yeah, send out to what they'll, you know, for episodes and movies, episodic TVs. And if they're looking for a character, say, 40 years old, six lines, balding, you know, it's a description of what they need for the movie or the episode, you mm-hmm. know? And the only one that get these breakdowns are the agents. So I started working with this agent out of his house, but he was a young kid. He wasn't like, you know, I'd be up at 6 o'clock, raring to go, drinking coffee, waiting until 9 o'clock so I can go to his house and help him go through it just to see what's out there and wondering if they were submitting me. Well, he's submitting me for the, you know, sending my picture. And then hopefully I get the call. And I'd say, did you call? So this lasted about 2 weeks. And I was driving him nuts, you know. So I says, you know what? I don't really trust this guy. I don't think he's doing the right job. So I would go up, wake up at 5 in the morning, run to his house, grab these breakdowns, run to Kinko's, copy them, then bring them back to his house, and then I would go through them myself. And I started submitting my own picture. And then I would call up in a few days and say, listen, my name is James Hoving. I'm Joe Ganascoli's manager. I'm in town for a few days, and I want to make sure that...
You would pretend that you were James Hoving... Joe Ganascoli's manager? Okay.
Yes. And I would, they'd say, who are you? I said, James Hoving. I'm Joe Ganascoli's manager. I want to make sure I'm in town for a few days. I want to make sure that he gets seen for this role. And they go, what? Where'd you say you were from? And I say, I'd have to say it. And I change my answering machine at home, say, James Hoving talent. I say, you know, I have an East Coast and a West Coast office. And that's how I started getting auditions. That's how I got my first role. And I got my SAG card.
Did anyone discover this, like, little con nope. game you were playing?
No. And then my roommate, who Tim, you know, the Jesuit, he says, listen, I need a James Hoving call. Can you call for me? And I'd say, call for him. You know, the funny story is that he wanted to get seen for a Bobby Kennedy movie. And I said, listen, you got to see Tim Keller. He's great. As a matter of fact, I signed him when he was playing all three Kennedys in an off-Broadway play. And because his agent wasn't getting him in, and I got him into he didn't get the role, but I got him in for the audition. So everybody was asking me to make James. I even Hoving calls because I started submitting. You know, I said, listen, there's a thing that's being cast you're really right for. So submit yourself, and I'll call up and... So I was doing people favors, and that's how I got. So I met my first movie I got was called Money for Nothing, and it's a who's who of like actors. I mean, it's a true story about a guy who finds $1 million in the street. A guy from Philly called Joey Coyle. His name is Joey Coyle, and it was called Money for Nothing. And James Gandolfini was in it. John Cusack was the lead. Gandolfini played his brother, Michael Madsen. I had a scene with Michael Madsen. I was like thrilled. They flew into Pittsburgh. First movie I ever got. And Michael Madsen, Philip Seymour Hoffman was in it, Michael Rapaport, Benicio del Toro, who I became friends with, mm-hmm. and he wound up directing me in a short film he wrote and directed called Submission with Matthew McConaughey. It's about a drug deal in a hotel. And so I stayed friends with him. After 3.5 years, I did a couple other movies, stayed friends with Benicio. I said, Benicio, that's it, I'm done. I don't know, man. I miss my family. I haven't been home in 3.5 years. And, you know, I will keep in touch. And if, you know, he could get me in any films. So he got me in two movies called Basquiat, about the painter, and The Funeral, directed by Abel Ferrara. And these were films that Georgianne Walken were casting and Sheila Jaffe, casting directors for The Sopranos. And they said, do you have an agent? I said, no. I said, well, keep in touch with us. You know, if anything comes by, you know, that you're right for, we'll bring in. And so I did that, and they started casting for The Sopranos, and that's how I got into that.
So did James Hoving help you get your role in The Sopranos?
No. By that time, you know, I was back in New York. You know, I did maybe, I did those two movies. And they said, just call us up and see, you know, what's right, what you're right for. So they said, well, listen, we're doing this show called The Sopranos, and we want to bring you in. And at the time, I didn't want to do it because I said, well, I don't want to do TV. I just want to do film. And they said, no, you come in and do this. It's going to be big. And you know, it was.
Well, you know, you became an actor because you lost a lot of money gambling and decided to go to L.A., you know, give up your restaurant,
right.
Sell your share in the restaurant, go to L.A. And try acting. Now that you actually have more money as a result of The Sopranos, are you in danger of gambling it away?
No, since I got married, I don't gamble anymore. I did lose a few dollars on the Super Bowl, which I stole all my bookie.
So, tell me one of your favorite stories about life on the set at The Sopranos.
Let's see. Well, usually when we kill someone, we take them out to dinner. I haven't gotten my dinner yet.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah, we took Jackie Jr., we took the guy who hung himself, Bobby Fornaro. I'm waiting for, that's usually a fun night.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Joe Gennascoli played Vito Spadafore on The Sopranos, and he co-wrote a crime novel called A Meal to Die For. Coming up, our critic at large, John Powers, tells us about some of the best and worst films he saw at the Cannes Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. The 59th Cannes Film Festival wrapped up on Sunday when the winners were announced. Cannes is the most important international film festival. Many of the movies that were shown there will be making their way to American theaters. Our critic at large, John Powers, who is also the film critic for Vogue, was at Cannes. We asked him to tell us about some of the best and worst films he saw there. John, welcome back to Fresh Air. Should we start with the grand prize winner?
Yes, I think that'd be a good idea.
So who was it?
The grand prize winner was a film by Ken Loach called The Wind That Shakes the Barley, not a particularly alluring title, I might add, which is a film about the Irish Troubles. And it's sort of a Warner Brothers-style movie about two brothers who wind up on opposite side of the Irish independence struggle. It's a political film, very much anti-British colonialism, and it's a very serious, sober left-wing movie.
Did you like it?
I thought it was okay. It's actually a nicely made movie. I mean, if you've seen the works of Ken Loach, who's made a lot of films and has been at Cannes a lot of times, I think there's a limit to how good they can ever be. He's a solid, studious, left-wing filmmaker who presents you with historical things in a way that aren't particularly exciting, but they're always intelligent.
Well, last year's grand prize winner, L'Enfant, I don't think it did that well here, and I've heard a lot of kind of disappointed responses to it.
Well, I think what's peculiar about Cannes in the award-giving ceremonies is that there's a weird kind of anhedonia that takes over among jurors, you know, because, you know, this year the film that everyone really, really liked most was a Pedro Almodovar film called Volver. I mean, if you looked at the critics' ratings, if you talked to people, the one thing you felt confident of was that was the one film that everyone at Cannes seemed to really like. Now, Almodovar has had lots of films at Cannes, and he never wins. And you start realizing, oh, that one reason he never wins is that his films are considered to be too pleasurable. There's, in fact, this.
Yeah,
this
that always bothers me when I see a movie too.
Yes, I know. I'm annoyed by people who can actually time their jokes well, and whose sentimental moments actually touch me rather than just make me groan. In talking to people, you realize that in the festival world, there's this strange sense that artistry doesn't include doing things that please the crowd as much as they might. So, you know, that Almodovar at Cannes is kind of like Howard Hawks or Alfred Hitchcock, you know, who famously never won Oscars. Almodovar goes all the time, often has the movie that people like the best, and then never wins. Because there's this strange perception that to make a movie that's well-plotted, well-acted, funny, touching, and in fact a crowd-pleaser is so easy to do, that, in fact, he shouldn't be honored for it. When, of course, you're always thinking to yourself, if it's so easy to make an Almodovar film, how come so much of the stuff you see in the world is so inept?
Well, he did win a couple of awards, though. He won Best Screenplay, and the actresses in the film shared the Best Actress Award.
Yes, one of the interesting things about Almodovar is he's one of the great directors of actresses in the world. In this particular film, he had Penelope Cruz, who came back from Hollywood and reminded us again that she's actually a really terrific actress when she's not acting in English. I mean, she's really wonderful. And his old, Almodovar's old actress, Carmen Maura, who was in a lot of his earlier films, and who they'd had some sort of split, but she came back. And you actually had those two plus two other actresses who were younger in between them. And in fact, it's a wonderful cast and extremely well performed. And at the time the film showed, many people thought, oh, the actresses will get an award because it's just a terrific ensemble.
Well, I love Almodovar's film, so I can't wait to see it. What were the big bombs of the Cannes Film Festival?
Well, the biggest single bomb, I think, was an American film called Southland Tales by a guy named Richard Kelly. It was his second film. His first film was kind of a cult hit called Donnie Darko, a film which I liked but, you know, didn't adore. But everyone was really excited to see his movie. The problem about Cannes for filmmakers is that the big film of the day shows at 8:30 in the morning. And this in a city where people during the festival are staying out really late at night. His film showed at 8:30 on a Sunday morning. It was 2 hours and 40 minutes long, sort of an apocalyptic comedy about Los Angeles, set in the year 2008 after a nuclear attack. And the movie is frankly a mess. People were walking out from about 20 minutes on. At the end, it got roundly booed. Various critics suggested it was the worst film ever to play at Cannes. And so it was like hugely unpopular. I was actually less hostile toward it because I thought here was a guy who'd actually gone for it, is that the movie is so overstuffed with jokes, many of them not funny, ideas, characters, that in a way I thought if you're going to make a film and it's going to come to Cannes, it should be really striving to be a big, amazing movie.
Before The Da Vinci Code had a chance to be panned by critics in daily newspapers, it opened at Cannes. What kind of reaction did it get there?
Silence. I didn't actually go to the official screening because, you know, that's for big shots. And it's essentially people with jewels and black tie who would go to the official opening night ceremony. But the people who were there, who I did know, all reported they'd never heard it so quiet. You could actually hear individual people clapping at the end, which is a kind of, it's almost worse than boos. Because people were just so stupefied by the dullness of the film that, you know, they just couldn't wait to get out and get to the party. It was very funny because that was the end of this huge process, at least in Europe, where the Da Vinci Code was as inescapable as sales tax. You know, every newspaper had the Da Vinci Code on the cover. You saw TV coverage of Tom Hanks taking the train from London to Cannes. Everything was going for the film. And then the film came in. Basically, no one liked it at Cannes, although it's obviously made a lot of money since then.
What are some of the most controversial films that showed this year at Cannes?
Well, there in controversy terms, the interesting film was something that would seem that it wouldn't be controversial, which was Sofia Coppola's film about Marie Antoinette, called Marie Antoinette, starring Kirsten Dunst as the famous, slightly airheaded queen of France. What the film does is treat Marie Antoinette not as a political figure, but as a teenage girl in love with boys and shopping and things. And it uses contemporary pop music, things like The Gang of Four, to tell the story of Marie Antoinette. It's the kind of film that if you like it, you think, what a terrifically interesting film, even if you don't like everything in it. it's also the kind of film, if you don't like it, you really hate it. And so the world divided profoundly on Marie Antoinette. There were probably lots of boos. I mean, there were certainly lots of boos, and there was lots of applause. You know, and you could actually summarize this difference in opinion if you looked at the New York Times, where one of the critics really liked it and one of the critics didn't like it, or in the rankings that they give at the festival, where various critics give their rating of every film. The French critics, for instance, half of them gave it 4 stars, the highest, and the other half were busy trashing it.
Where do you fall on this scale?
It's so embarrassing to say that I'm slightly in the middle. I did like it, but I saw that the second half isn't as good as the first half. But I, like many critics, liked the fact that it was trying to take a new approach to making a historical film. One very famous French critic named Michel Simon, you know, came up to me and said, "It is not perfect, but, you know, if a Frenchman had made this film, it would be so dull and so predictable." And in fact, I think that's what I felt about Marie Antoinette. It is so lively and youthful and American and pop that if you want a serious film about Marie Antoinette, who after all didn't lead a perfect life, I mean, given that her excesses helped people starve to death, if you don't like that pop idea of Marie Antoinette, then the film strikes you as not just foolish but almost morally reprehensible. And in fact, at the press conference, Sofia Coppola was asked about the politics of the film. And she said, I think quite honestly, that she'd had no political thoughts about the film at all. You know, for her, Marie Antoinette is no longer a political figure. She's a young girl whose life she wanted to talk about.
Now, there's a film I read a little bit about called Summer Palace that's set in China. And what surprises me is apparently there's actual sex and nudity in it, which I think is unusual for a film out of China. And, China censors its films.
It is. You know, the film is an interesting idea. It's about the generation of Tiananmen Square, the young people who were young at the time of Tiananmen Square in 1989. But its approach to this is to tell you the story of that era, not through the work of a political activist, but through the life of a young woman who's basically discovering herself through her sexual encounters with men. So that during Tiananmen Square, she joins the students, but mainly because her boyfriend is there and she wants to be close to him. And what the film does is it gives you a period of about, you know, maybe 15 years of life in China through the eyes of this young woman whose major obsessions are romantic and erotic. In the process of doing that, you actually do have very, very rare nude scenes. And quite explicit nude scenes in the film that I'd never seen before in a Chinese film. Certainly one with this level of acting and commitment. I mean, it wasn't some sort of grubby little underground film where they're showing somebody naked just to make a splash. And what was interesting about it to me, especially the nudity in the film, is that the Chinese don't quite know how to do it yet. You know, that they have had so few of these films that they slightly overdo it with the sex and the nudity. So even though I'm a middle-aged man who should like nothing more than to see naked Chinese women, I'm thinking, enough with this already. Can we get back to the story? You know, and I suspect by the time that it comes out in the States, and I think it will come out in the States, that will be pared back, because one of the excesses is a guy who's trying to use eroticism as a subject, but who doesn't quite know the rules for how you do it without going too far. I would say in passing that among the women I know, this might have been the favorite film at the festival.
What do you think accounts for that?
I think it captures a kind of female character that movies don't deal with very often, which is a woman who is driven, but she doesn't quite know what she's driven for and driven to seek. And the way her life takes its form is in her relationships with individual men and through her sexual relationships. You know, she's not crazy. She's intelligent. She's able to hold down work. She's not some sad looking for Mr. Goodbar type. She's actually a woman who's almost exploding with so much feeling. She's trying to find some place to put it, which is all the harder in China of, say, 1988, where you were supposed to suppress all your individuality. In a sense, the film is almost about the birth of individualism in China and uses this woman as the exemplar of that.
My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. We'll talk more about the Cannes Film Festival after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ My guest is our critic at large, John Powers, and he just came back from the Cannes Film Festival. John, the Cannes Film Festival is, of course, a place to premiere new films. It's also a place to sell films. And tell us a little bit about what the marketplace was like this time around.
Yes, well, you know, part of the fun of Cannes is that it is all of the world is there. It's kind of like going to India, where there's just so much stuff. So at the upper levels of the Palais, where they show the films, you have the high art films, you know, by great international auteurs. In the basement, they have the market. And in the market are all the films that many Americans would never see unless they, you know, check the made-for-video or straight-to-video shelves at their DVD store. You know, those are the films that have, you know, the brothers of Sylvester Stallone and all those actors who used to be part of the Brat Pack, and you wonder whatever happened to them. You know, they're all making movies. And, you know, so you have crazy sex movies and you have lots of action movies. A lot of the movies that are aimed at the international audience. I had a particular favorite this year. You know, every year you find something that seems particularly delirious. My favorite this year was a thing called XD Hair Extensions. And there was a promotional reel available, but the synopsis of the film, which I will read to you because it's so insane, is simply, "Hair extensions carry the grudge of the individual to which the hair originally belonged and start attacking people wearing them at random."
That's funny.
Isn't that funny? I mean, it sounds like a joke film. You know, that's something that you'd read in a novel about how absurd the world is. But in fact, this film is directed by a respectable Japanese director. Its lead actress is the woman who played Gogo Suvari in Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill. That in fact, it's a real project. And the market is filled with those things. You know, every time you go there, every day there are market screenings and you're looking and there are stories that seem so insane you can't believe it. And you realize that this is actually somehow the darker libido of the film industry. And then you have the high aspiration, you know, on the floors above.
I know one of the movies that was premiered at Cannes was Al Gore's film about global warming, An Inconvenient Truth. How was he received there?
Oh, Al Gore was received very, very well. You know, I mean, you know, normally what happens when I go to a film festival is I wind up making jokes about Paris Hilton because she seems to be everywhere. This time, Al Gore took over the Paris Hilton role. You know, I think it's because, you know, you so seldom get a politician at Cannes, especially such a famous one, and then with a film there, you know, that he was at dinners and giving press conferences and on yacht parties and everything. You know, Al Gore is everywhere. I sort of thought that he may not be running for president of the United States, but he looked like he was running for the president of next year's Cannes jury. I mean, and he was having such a good time. You know, I think that's part of it is that he's there promoting the film and getting caught up in the events like everybody else. I mean, it's a very sleepless place, Cannes. I mean, everyone talks about how they go to bed at 1:30 in the morning and get up at 7:30. And the horror is when you go to bed at 1:30 in the morning, you still can't sleep because you're so wired. And you can even feel that in him, which was actually kind of nice since so often when he's officially running for things, he seems kind of stiff, to actually see him in kind of loosey-goosey mode.
Why do you go every year to the Cannes Film Festival?
The reason I go to Cannes is that the whole world is there. That it is exhilarating and exhausting. It's filled with refinement and vulgarity. And when you go, you will see things and meet people you wouldn't meet anyplace else. You actually see the film by the director from Mauritania. You see the film from Paraguay when they haven't had a film in 30 years. And it doesn't matter whether you like it. Plus, you see what in the world is thought to be the most exciting film being made. You see Hollywood movies, you see French movies, you see Korean movies, and you talk to people. You know, you talk to critics from Mexico or from Greece, the kind of people you don't normally meet. So you learn a lot about the world. You know, in fact, one of the funny things, you know, for people who live in the U.S. now is that given that we're constantly being told about how globalized our world is and how we have to know the world because of September 11th, it's amazing how little we actually get to see in this country of what people think about movies or what movies they make outside the United States. There are a handful of countries whose movies show here. And then if you go to a film festival, you might be able to see it. But in Cannes, it's all there. So I'm excited every time because I always see something I never have seen before. I meet someone I could never meet anyplace else. And it's a thrilling place to be.
Well, John, thanks for talking with us about the Cannes Film Festival.
Sure, happy to do it.
John Powers is our critic at large and film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurach directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music from the soundtrack of Pedro Almodovar's 2004 film, Bad Education.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Snakeskin Shamisen, a Mas Arai mystery by Naomi Hirahara, author of Gasa Gasa Girl. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Picture House, presenting the Robert Altman film A Prairie Home Companion, with a cast that includes Tommy Lee Jones, John C. Reilly, and Meryl Streep, opening June 9th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Hans Blix, the former head of weapons inspection for the United Nations. He now heads the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, an independent commission whose goal is to free the world of WMD. Blix is issuing a new report to the UN. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.